Good afternoon, fellow Patriots. This is Matt Shea, and welcome to Patriot Radio, broadcasting live from the capital of free Washington and hopefully the future capital of the state of liberty, Spokane Valley. Brought to you once again by the committee to elect Matt Shea, Republican, in the legacy of Dr. Stan Monteith, bringing you the story behind the story and the news behind the news. And once again, this is a year we make freedom a reality, and it can't just stop with the election. This has got to be a continual process because our hope is not in man, but in Jesus Christ. And we can't end in prayer. We must also move to action. And as Jeremiah 6:16 reminds us, stand at the crossroads and look, ask for the ancient paths, ask where the good way is and walk in it, and you will find rest for your souls. And truly what we're looking for is a rebirth of freedom. And right now, just before I came on the air, breaking news out of Trump Tower in New York. Ryan Zinke, the congressman from Montana, is Trump's pick for Secretary of the Interior, beating out Kathy McMorris Rodgers. And I think that you all probably understand the implications of that, but I will get to it here a little bit later in the show. But that is breaking news just as we came on, and he intends to accept that nomination. We have a bunch of things on the news today, and I want to go through them fairly quickly. But from the local level to the international level, I want to give you kind of a picture of where I think things are going to be heading. And so we'll start with your daily intelligence briefing on the international front. With what is Trump doing with his pick for Secretary of State, and then you have this, what looks like Chinese acrimony toward the United States. Trump needs to fall in line. The rookie Trump needs to fall in line coming out of this, the Chinese state media. Here's what I think is going on. I think Trump is signaling with his Secretary of State pick, Rex Tillerson, that he wants to draw closer to Russia in a relationship similar to that during World War II. And I hope not compromise on Ukraine, but he wants to draw closer to Russia, bring some peace and stability to the Middle East through that relationship, and at the same time isolate China. And I think that's why China's reacting the way it is right now and why it's trying to expand its markets dramatically and its holdings in Australia and New Zealand. Now, they've been buying up a lot of things, and the Australians are watching it very warily right now. And what I really believe is shaping up is this isolation of China. I really do. And Rex Tillerson and his relationships with the Russians and folks in the Russian oil industry in particular, and the fact that Trump's very outspoken. Rebirth of freedom here in America, rebirth of manufacturing here in America, rebirth of jobs here in America approach, there's only one country that's going to affect dramatically, and that's going to be China. I mean, it'll affect some other ones, but one that it will affect dramatically, and that is China. Also on the international front, I talked about how the Jewish high priest has been selected. The Sanhedrin has been reconstituted. All the accoutrements, clothing, etc. have been remade for a new temple to be built. At the same time, the United Nations is trying to change the Temple Mount to Muslim. And folks, I'm going to have a guest on here in the next couple of weeks to talk about, from a Jewish perspective, different things that are in Scripture that really kind of point to this time. But the fact of the matter is that if the third temple is built, I mean, that is a very significant signal to Christians. And maybe this peace between the United States and Russia will allow something like that to happen in the Middle East. But it has some very significant implications, and they aren't all good. Okay? So understand that the time we live in, that some of these things really have a greater, even than historical context and geostrategic context, these have a very clear biblical context as well. Which brings us to the next thing on the international front, is that cloud. I don't know if you guys have seen the video on this, but you got to check it out online. There was this cloud, this pillar of cloud that stood on the border between Israel and Syria and the Golan. And it was, I mean, it was a cloud of, a dark cloud of sand and dust standing there between the soldiers of the IDF and ISIS. Very interesting. So take a look at that. There seem to be more of these types of things happening in the world, and some people poo-poo it. We're admonished as Christians to look and know the signs of the times and the season that we are in. And I think that we really need to be paying attention to some of these things. Also on the international front, the Italians and their continued rebuke of the globalists, Renzi has resigned. And one of the interesting parts about this, the Italian country right now is looking at one of the oldest banks in the world, 500 years old plus, potentially collapsing, which could have a domino effect with other banks across the world. Now, Monday, a lot of people thought it was really tenuous then. And so I'm going to keep my eye on Italy, kind of like we kept our eye on Greece here about 2 years ago, watching what was happening, because it really portended some things that people said wouldn't happen, and they did, where you have a lot of banks really close to financial ruin, which can have a domino effect across the entire world. And we're going to keep our eyes on this one in Italy. And I got word actually from people in Italy to watch for this. So really appreciate my Italian friends. And I know they appreciate freedom as well. And that's why I think we're seeing a rebirth of freedom in Italy too, with this rebuke of the globalists and the no vote on the referendum. Also on the international front, the United States, United Kingdom, their spy agencies spied on international airline passengers, and that finally was revealed as part of Snowden's archives that this was occurring, and that they were getting data from cell phones that were being used in real time. So what was once poo-pooed as conspiracy theory is now actually fact again. On the national front, and I really want to spend a little bit of time on this one because I don't think a lot of people understand the implications of this. But BBC actually is reporting about this, and it's reporting about predictive algorithms and this huge advance that we have seen and the ubiquitous use of these predictive algorithms, which... And I've mentioned this before when I talked about activity-based intelligence, where we gather, you know, and the United States is doing this right now, there's other countries doing this right now, where they gather intelligence, but not in the ways you think. They gather all of the indicators, all the behavior, all the connections and relationships and comments and everything, and then they create with this massive amount of data predictions about what you will do or how you will react to certain things. And then they introduce those certain things as stimulus to literally change behavior. And so BBC is talking about how these predictive algorithms are making us small-minded and limiting choices. And that's exactly what I was talking about. Then if you can gather enough data on people, then you can start manipulating their behavior by reintroducing stimulus because you know how they're going to react. And that's what we're talking about right now. BBC has finally come out and admitted that this stuff exists, but everybody's using them. Amazon, probably the most well-known. But I think this is something we need to have a conversation about. How are we going to protect people from being manipulated when a lot of people don't even know they are being manipulated? And that this data is being gathered. And again, this goes to the privacy aspect of things. How much of my information should be used, if any at all? How should it be acquired, if at all? And again, bringing up some very significant privacy concerns. Also on the national front, my favorite headline of the year so far, GOP readies cuts to federal workforce. About time. You know, I hear this knee-jerk reaction to crises. We got to raise taxes. And every time you bring up, hey, why don't we cut out mid and upper level management? Why don't we implement efficiencies? Why don't we reduce the workforce? Without affecting core services on the ground, reduce the workforce, save money, make government more efficient and not so darn bloated, instead of doing tax increases. And nobody ever wants to go down that road because it's hard to go down that road. You might get made fun of publicly. You might get pilloried by the left. But ultimately, that's what the solution is. And so I'm glad to see the GOP is looking at doing that at the national level. And let's hold their feet to the fire and make sure they do. And they should start with the 10,000 employees in the Bureau of Land Mismanagement and the horrific treatment they have done of ranchers and farmers here in the West. I think that would be a good start. I hope you agree. And probably the EPA at the same time. Well, continuing on the national front, more appointments. Ryan Zinke again, Montana congressman, being tapped by Trump for Secretary of the Interior. Rex Tillerson, Exxon CEO, being tapped for Secretary of State, again for his relationships that he has, especially with the Russians. Now, the media is making him out to be a Russian puppet. And by the way, I find it so interesting and disingenuous. Here you have the socialists and communists in the media, the mainstream media, coming out and saying that, you know, this guy is some sort of a Russian sympathizer merely because he has business relationships with him and has good relationships with him. I just find that fascinating to me. How the times change. Also on the national front, Brian Williams, the penultimate example of journalistic integrity coming out against fake news. If that one story does not just completely crush the integrity of mainstream media, I don't know what does. I mean, that is just one of the funniest headlines that I've seen all year. Moving on to the regional front, we're going to be here in Olympia, starting session here the second week of January. We're going to be doing a live video broadcast for the Freedom Agenda to tell you about what's going on, how you can be involved, how you can help. And we're going to start not just talking about bills in that, you know, the here's what the bill is about, but giving some background to some of these bills and some of the behind the scenes stuff to these bills and where they came from, how old of an idea is it, who always runs this, that kind of thing. So you really get an idea of what we face in Olympia, what you face as the people of the, you know, as far as the decisions that are made in Olympia. And one of the interesting things that has come up recently is this briefing we received on drones in automated cars. And if you didn't hear this from the last show, briefly, they are literally testing right now an automated air traffic control system regarding drones, and that they believe within the next 5 years, and probably starting within the next two, drone delivery of packages is going to be the norm. It will be the norm. And that you actually might have your own personal drone that could go and pick things up for you, like a prescription or something like that at store. And that this is going to be the norm. And they're testing this automated air traffic control system. Also, within 2 to 5 years, they're going to have automated cars on the road. And this is not a conceptual idea. They are testing this right now. Now, there have been several accidents, and they talked about some of those accidents that have occurred and the solutions to prevent them from happening in the future. But the fact of the matter is automated cars are going to be on our roads here in 2 to 5 years. I mean, this is not science fiction. Now, I kind of bring up this question. What about automated flying cars? And there are flying cars. You can actually go to Moeller.com. They've had them since the 1970s, believe that or not. They just couldn't figure out how to actually license them. You know, should it be treated like a plane, a car? These were kind of the discussions, especially in California, they were having on these issues. But for all of us, are we ready for that? What are the implications of it? What happens if the power goes out? If there's an EMP from the sun or man-made? I mean, just some significant things that I think we need to start talking about in earnest, because if we're going to go in this direction, we need to be ready for it. And also, people becoming so lazy and dependent. And if you haven't watched the movie Surrogate with Bruce Willis, I would strongly recommend you watch it, because it's almost like where this is going, where people just sit in their houses and don't interact with anybody else. Very curious, and really, truly a brave new world. Also on the regional front, I want to go over a few bills that have been introduced that have received national attention. One of them in particular, I would consider fake news. But I want to start with the 51st state, the state of liberty. Now, there was a myth out there that this was not popular. KXLY did a poll. Over 8,000 people weighed in, and 73% in support of the state of liberty. Article 4, Section 3 of the U.S. Constitution is what spells out the process by which you can split a state. Now, there's some people out there, very uneducated, wouldn't listen when I said go read the primary source document, said that's unconstitutional. Well, clearly it's not. Article 4, Section 3, plain wording for the process of splitting a state. Then I had some people say, this is not serious. Well, I got to tell you, a lot of people I'm talking to are very serious about this, and we're going to continue moving forward. We have a committee meeting to draft a proposed constitution for the new state. We have several individuals that have sent in ideas for a flag, and I'm going to be putting that out on the Join the 51st State Movement page so people can weigh in on what they think the flag should look like. And we get a flag for this thing, we're going to have bumper stickers and everything else, too. I'm pushing this forward. You know, I'm sick and tired of the platitudes coming from the west side of the state, downtown Seattle, and how we should run our lives over here in eastern Washington. And they say, oh, we just want to talk about it. Well, they don't listen. It's not just us talking about it. We want to have a serious conversation, because our views keep getting ignored election after election, legislative session after legislative session. And so we're going to continue to push this forward. Now, some people have said, we're a bunch of welfare freeloaders over here in eastern Washington, and we would never survive without the tax base of the West. We would have to raise taxes to unsustainable levels. And my response to that is simple. That is a logical fallacy. We would not have the same size and scope of bloated government, inefficient government, wasteful government that the west side of the state has. We just wouldn't. We'd have the opportunity to start fresh. We'd have the opportunity to have a balance between rural areas and cities as far as voting was concerned, maybe a more electoral style system. And it would reflect clearly our values here in eastern Washington. And that brings us to the next two bills that I introduced that went national as the left just went into a tizzy fit about this stuff. The first is parental notification. You know, I believe that if there's going to be a life-threatening procedure, now I believe abortion is killing a human life, an innocent human life. But it is very clear in our law that if there is going to be that sort of a life-threatening procedure where somebody could die as a result of it, that parents should be notified when it's a minor child. When you go into court and you talk about medical negligence issues, every other issue, that's the case. Why is it different suddenly for abortion? And in Eastern Washington, this is roundly supported. You know, but once again, the west side of the state tries to dictate to us, and to great shame of Washington, we actually legalized abortion before Roe versus Wade. A lot of people don't know that. And then there was this stadium gun bill. The left just went nuts over this. You know, how could anybody support a gun in a stadium? Well, first of all, I can't believe that anybody would be against your ability to defend yourself in one of the most likely terrorist targets in the country are stadiums and arenas. How could you possibly defend that? Even worse, there have been off-duty cops that have been turned out because they were carrying concealed. And then the left tried to blow this up with fear-mongering. Oh, you guys want assault weapons. And there's no such thing as assault weapon, by the way. But you want assault weapons in our stadiums. Nobody said that. We're talking about concealed carry after somebody has gone through a rigorous background check and has been fingerprinted. Well, you want guns around people that are drunk. Well, first of all, if the stadium is over-serving, that's already against the law. So maybe we should address that problem separately. But just because somebody else is getting drunk illegally doesn't mean that you have to take away my right to defend myself and my family. Then here's the part that a lot of people don't know. It's actually already law in Washington State. RCW 9.41.300. So 941-300, subsection 2B. If you read that, it clearly says that stadiums and convention centers cannot prohibit concealed carry, period, for all jurisdictions. In fact, it's under the state preemption law. So what was happening is these public facility districts and stadium authorities were going out and contracting around that law, so they didn't have to comply with the law. And my bill just simply fixes that. Now, you're not hearing that in the media. You know, all over the mainstream media, oh, they want guns. It's already the law. So I would call that fake news. I would call this total fake news that the media tries to drum up to scare people away from an inherent God-given unalienable right. And once again, it's the west side of the state that has been super objectionable on these types of issues and has reached out and said, oh, Eastern Washington, we are in a flyover state. I saw that comment on social media. The fact of the matter is, another reason to split the state in two. And on that note, I want to end on the local front with this. I have some bombshell information. It's a revelation that is going to change the way that you look at local media on the issue of the 51st state. It's going to change the way that you look at the whole idea of a 51st state and the state of liberty. And I'm going to be breaking this out over a period of months, actually. There's so much information that I have received today, and you're just going to be absolutely blown away by this, and I look forward to, on the next show, breaking this and starting down this road, and I hope it encourages you that this the 51st state movement is not just real, it is doable. And that's the briefing. Remember, the antidote to dependency and socialism is to be a God-fearing, self-reliant, freedom-loving American. And thank you to everybody that has been praying for us. Make sure you go to Facebook/Patriot Radio US, like the page, share it with your friends and family. And if you get a chance, just send a note on Facebook and tell us what you like most about the show and also how we can be a resource to you better out in Eastern Washington and parts beyond. Well, it's my honor and privilege today to introduce you to my guest, Justin Murda, who was a candidate for insurance commissioner, but generally an activist and a thinker and somebody who understands the health insurance industry and some of the things that are going on in the health insurance industry that really are, I think, hurting American families. Justin, thanks for joining me on Patriot Radio today.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here today.
So, let me start with this. What prompted you to run for insurance commissioner first? I mean, obviously the election didn't go your way, but I mean, what prompted you to do that?
There is a few reasons. My backstory is I had actually lived in Southeast Asia for about 6 years, and you just kind of get a different perspective on the world and how you fit in that. And I think that I was kind of compelled to come back and do something instead of complaining or being like an internet warrior and talking about, you know, these changes that need to be made. And I felt that, you know, it was you know, my civic duty to try to be a part of the system instead of sitting back and kind of taking a, you know, from the couch type of approach to it. And I didn't expect to win the first time that I ran for office. I, you know, was more or less trying to feel out the process and, you know, and see how everything worked. And I'm really satisfied with how everything turned out, and I think that it was a really great experience.
It's amazing when you go outside of the United States and then you come back how starkly different the rest of the world really is from kind of the way we live, but there's also some great similarities as well.
Oh, sure, definitely.
So what struck you the most about, you know, Southeast Asia compared to the United States of America?
Well, I actually lived in Vietnam, and it's, you know, a wholly communist country, so it's kind of, you know, in principle, I guess, you know, really the direct opposite of how we would function as a government. And you kind of see how that works, you know, from a firsthand experience instead of, you know, just always hearing about, you know, like the Red Curse or, you know, commies this or communism that. And you can see firsthand, you know, like what the general failings are within, you know, that type of system. And, you know, I think it really brought a unique perspective. And as you see a lot of institutions progressing more and more, you know, past the socialist barrier or socialism barrier into the socialist/communist boundaries, it really starts to push those lines to an unacceptable level, in my opinion. And I felt that, you know, maybe I could come back and, you know, kind of give a better insight or retrospect to, you know, a lot of these, you know, trends or, you know, these kind of, you know, government and political leanings.
So I look at the way that some things operate over in that part of the world, and collectivism is just kind of a given. I mean, it's not even argued anymore. But here in America, I mean, we're still very independent. We believe, at least in this area of the country, we believe to a large extent in being self-reliant, freedom-oriented. We believe in the free market, but we kind of don't have a free market anymore, especially in the area of healthcare.
Oh, sure, definitely. And again, that's one of the reasons why I came back. I you can totally see that, you know, these markets that we've always relied on as being, you know, somewhat controlled or unbiasedly controlled or regulated. Now it's just, I mean, it's, you know, leaning towards a one payer, you know, no freedom to the system. It's so regulated that it's, you know, I mean, really, especially speaking on healthcare, I mean, it's really so regulated and it's so controlled. It's in a way really pitiful because you can't even separate the insurance from the healthcare industry. And I think that, you know, a lot of the reason is most of our consumers, they're kept in the dark so much about how things are priced and how really the providers work with networks, those networks work with the insurance companies, et cetera. Like they can't really distinguish one entity from the other. And I think that that's really one of the main reasons for, you know, I think one, the disillusion in the actual services and everything, as well as, you know, the actual participation within the whole industry itself. I mean, I think a lot of people really don't understand that, you know, we have a huge shortage of providers because, you know, you have people that are so, you know, disenfranchised from actually wanting to become a doctor all the way to, you know, the fact that, you know, they can't understand the pricing because there is no transparency or really a solid regulation between what is usual, customary, and reasonable any longer.
Well, let's walk through this. I mean, there's this hospital in Oklahoma that does all cash basis, has kind of a menu-based system. You go in, hey, I want that surgery. The price is fixed. They have one of the lowest rates of reinfection in the hospital. highest success rates for their surgeries. They have high retention rates for their doctors and nurses. And yet, in Washington State, we're trending exactly opposite. I mean, what do you chalk that up to? And if you can, describe for the listeners, and take a little bit of time to do this if you want, but describe for the listeners what is the market and how does it actually work and how should it work?
Well, like I said, there's really, I mean, that's the problem, is that there's really not a market, because you have the insurance companies that have kind of created a blurred line between all these boundaries. When a person goes to your average facility, let's say they get a broken leg, they might go to three or four different facilities or hospitals, and the prices for those three hospitals might vary as much as 1,000 to 2,000% in cost, which is huge. I mean, kind of put that into even more of a layman's term, one hospital might charge $1,000 for the broken leg, one hospital might charge $10,000, and the other one might charge $3,000. So the consumer will never really know what that price is, because the prices are all hidden. You go there and you have your insurance card, you pay your deductible, or you pay whatever your out-of-pocket maximum is for that service, and then you go home, and a lot of times, most people don't really read their explanation of benefits and any type of billing or anything like that. The bills are usually absorbed by the administrative practices at the insurance company, so they never really know how much that procedure costs, and, it never really dawned on them to go and look to see if there were any other, more expensive or less expensive options. And a lot of that, depends on, the emergency or the urgency of what needs to be fixed. And for the longest time, you couldn't really even, ethically, you couldn't advertise or promote, your prices and services as a healthcare organization or a health facility. And a lot of that has to do with price gouging. And it started as like a practice that would protect the consumer, but now it's become a way to keep the consumer in the dark. So we never really know what the prices are for anything. And now we're really starting to see the brunt of what those costs actually are, because now you have a lot of the quote unquote insurances that are, they're at like the maximum thresholds for what's allowed for, this Affordable Care Act stuff, which, you have $5,000 deductibles, which almost match, the old out-of-pocket maximums. So now you have a lot of people that are going to the doctor and they're like, man, I'm not going to pay $200 for an office visit, or they're not going to pay for certain things. So you have two things that happen. One, it more or less kind of creates an opportunity for more of a free market, because now you can see some of these clinics are getting a little bit more competitive, where they're offering, basic services for, certain prices to try to incentivize people to come in and use their preventive care and whatnot, which, it would be great if there were, more options. But the problem is that you have such a limited amount of providers that you don't really have the effect of an overall, free market, because those, providers will still all kind of work in collusion, and they all see each other's prices, so they can all kind of, essentially make, this, overall price barrier that you're not going to be able to get past. And then, the other problem that you have is, the facilities are still, kind of loosely, run by whatever local or city governments, and they have certain incentives and kickbacks, publicly, with taxes and stuff like that. So it's like you're never really going to, get away from, this pervasive, hand in the cookie jar, so to speak, when it comes to that. So it's like we're in the, worst case of the worst case, and I think the only way to really break out of that is allowing more, home calls, or, looking at different that could kind of do like what Uber did, where, you have essentially the business model put into individual providers' hands and then coordinated by the people themselves. But, I mean, it's really tough to kind of get in there and change, people's perceptions, because I mean, even when I go out, people are still like, well, I don't know what my insurance is. And, I think it's Premera or I think it's Blue Cross. And I just go to Blue Cross or I just go to Blue Cross doctors. And, they have no idea of what the insurance really means or what any of it really actually comes down to when it comes to, a fair market or free market type of availability to them.
So this is what I want to kind of get into a little bit. I mean, I've heard people having their premiums literally increase by double. Some people paying $2,400 a month for their family. I don't even know how that's. I don't know how you could survive with something like that.
Oh,
How does that work? I mean, you're choosing literally between your home or heating or food, and healthcare.
Well, the problem and how we've got there is simple. I mean, we before it battled antitrust and monopolies, but we're at that point where that is what's happening. You have total monopolies within the provider networks. Only so many people can access, or only so many companies can access those networks. And those three or four insurance companies, they're all for profit. None of them are really not non-profit or not for profit. So if you're a part of those insurance companies, or you're a small business owner or whatever, and you have to utilize those insurance companies to indemnify or cover your family, you're playing by three or four people's rules. And so when they think that they're not going to make a profit, all they have to do is send Mike a reason or an explanation for the increase, which usually comes down to blah blah blah. Our underwriting models aren't going to make us profitable if we don't increase these premiums. And so if you go, man, I really don't want to pay these premiums because I can't afford it, I'm going to go to something cheaper. Well, you can't, because group health is mirrored Regents, which is mirrored Premera, which is Blue Cross. I mean, you're all the chips are stacked against you, and there's no foreign entities or other states that are really allowed to come in with cheaper rates to try to force any type of competitiveness. So I mean, you really have an oligarchy of three or four insurance companies that control everything.
Well, I'd like to hit on one of the other interesting parts about this too, and that's, for example, emergency room visits. People that should be going to the doctor, they go to the emergency room, it costs $700 in the emergency room, but if they had gone to their doctor, it would cost maybe $150 and be a dramatic savings to everybody. How do you address something like that? I mean, how can you fix that type of behavior?
Well, there's a few ways to fix it. I mean, we can have, like I said before, smarter consumers or incentivize consumers. There's all kinds of telemedicine programs and stuff like that that allow people to, essentially get the medicines that they need or get, the attention that they need in a timely manner in order to, kind of subside or alleviate whatever condition that they have. But really, one, nobody's controlling the emergency room and saying, hey, these prices are ridiculous. I mean, even if you go to an urgent care clinic or an after-hours clinic, you're not going to pay these kind of prices. But, for example, if you go out on the peninsula and you're in a place like Sequim, you only have so many urgent care or after-hours clinics that are available to you within a certain driving distance. Now, when you come to the point where you're like, I really need medicine right now, or I need this right now, you might understand that you don't have an emergency, but you have insurance that can pay or cover your bill to a certain amount that you're going to agree to know that you can go and get some type of assistance for whatever that condition is right now. Most people are going to go and do that. And so, there should be some type of 24-hour, on-call physician person that should be able to take care of your needs. And a lot of municipalities and stuff have rules and regulations against that. So, but you can fault your municipalities. You can also fault tort reform, because a lot of doctors, after certain hours, the malpractice insurance is so high because you're seeing, maybe at-risk patients or patients that, might, fall out of, what their insurance category is. So it's too high of a premium for them to, to have such a clinic. I mean, it's really like a perfect storm of reasons for why you have high ER utilization and these high costs. I mean, it's I think a poor effort on everybody's part, all the way from the consumer to our state and federal government.
Well, you kind of alluded to one solution, and I've heard this actually mentioned by Donald Trump, and that is the idea of portability and allowing insurance policies, and particularly allowing catastrophic insurance policies across state lines. And then the second solution being some sort of a health savings account where you can put in money tax-free and you can make your decisions, better decisions, and pay in cash, which would obviously lower the price across the entire market, because you wouldn't have the, reimbursements of pennies on the dollar as much going on as we do today.
Oh, sure, sure. I think both of those are two good interim solutions. But I think it needs to be a lot broader. I think, one, we should be able to have foreign entities provide policies. Because in essence, most people don't understand that, reinsurance and these catastrophic coverages and stuff, they a lot of times will be underwritten on paper that can be traced all the way back to Lloyd's. So, I mean, most things are generally underwritten on contracts that are under, these foreign investment portfolios and stuff. And I think they should take it one step further and allow foreign underwriting and allow a lot of foreign countries to create a product that's affordable for people, and let the market determine whether or not those policies are going to be solvent or not. I think that it would be totally fair if a company in Mexico wanted to offer somebody an insurance policy in the state of Washington. But again, you have lots of you have lots of people that wouldn't like that, because it's going to cut right into their bottom line. I would, we no one really knows, but I would wager to say that insurance companies like Regents Blue Shield and Premera make such an enormous amount of profit off of off of their clients that it would just be mind-boggling that that you would almost have to look at it from a perspective of price gouging, or you'd really want some type of justification for what they're doing. But again, there's no transparency in what they're doing. They have these incredibly high premium rates that they're taking in. There's no way to track exactly what they're paying out for claims, and they don't have to be transparent. So again, that's a huge issue. I do like the idea of health savings accounts and, making things, tax, no dollar, or you get no taxation on the dollars that go in, and, can be no tax or limited tax by how, you pull out and utilize those dollars, whether or not it's, towards the health costs or whatnot.
Right.
And the HSAs are, they're good, and I think that's nice, but they still don't really address, the problems of when you do really get sick. They don't do anything to, really, once you get to the level of the facility and people are that sick, you can have really small populations drive enormous amounts of cost, because the hospitals are allowed to pretty much charge whatever they want to charge for any type of procedures. So you might have an individual that, never gets really sick a day in their life, and then all of a sudden they have, end-stage renal failure. So you're going to go from, basically generating no claims to, getting thousands of dollars a month. and why would it, you know, why does kidney dialysis and these types of treatments cost so much when you can go to Asia and there's like backpacks that you can put on that can essentially function as well or better than most kidney dialysis facilities in the United States. But yet we're still charging, you know, getting charged like $26,000 or $10,000 a month for these treatments. The same goes with prescription care. I mean, you have like prescription costs that are, you know, phenomenally high. And they keep chalking it up to, oh, it's research and development. It's research and development. We're spending all this money on research, so we have to recoup, you know, our cost through the drugs. Because once the research is done, I mean, you're essentially making pills for 15 cents a piece, and then you're selling those pills for $100. You know, so it's like, where, what are these breaking points, you know, that they're talking about? How much money goes, you know, to the research and development of any given drug before it finally defaults back to, you know, where it's aspirin prices or, you know, it's like flu medicine prices. And again, it, you know, there's just nothing being done to address that, because anytime somebody tries to attack these complicated issues and they go, okay, we're going to go after these hospitals and we're going to make sure that, you know, they're not generating, you know, enormous profits like this and they're actually, you know, spending and putting back into their communities, et cetera, et cetera. Those institutions get shut down, or those people get voted out of office, or, you know, I mean, you take your pick, but nothing's being done. I mean, you have an insurance commissioner right now that, I mean, although he says that he works on behalf of, you know, the consumer in the state, I mean, it's really, I mean, a lackluster job, because, I mean, you see that, you know, you have these, you know, the oligarchy of insurance companies controlling the state exchange and using all the government money to, you know, help their company, even though they're doing everything for profit. You have limited choices on what you have as far as anything from providers to facilities to go to, and you don't have any options from any foreign entities that can try to alleviate any type of premium prices. So, I mean, until, you know, we actually get regulation that's on our side, or we abolish the regulation, we're going to continue to flounder in the same situation for years to come.
Well, let me ask this question then about I can easily sit here and say, from a liberty-minded standpoint, that government intervention in the market is what skewed everything.
Right.
Government intervention in the market with mandatory reimbursement rates have created, you know, prices to go up in other areas to make up for the loss in that area. Exactly. I can say that those same mandates have resulted in shortages of doctors who don't want to deal with the system anymore, and dentists who don't want to deal with the system anymore.
Yep,
but people will argue, they'll come back around on the other side, and they'll say, but if you decentralize the system and you let the free market rule, there's going to be a lot of abuse. How do you address that type of mentality?
Well, I think that that the way you have to make these types of things work is you have to have kind of a carrot and a stick approach. And I think what's happened is there's no more stick to anything. So it's like you have any of these companies that abuse certain privileges or take advantage of consumers or whatever, nothing happens to them. I mean, you know, if you go, you know, back to the financial crisis in 2008 and you look at the housing bubble that burst, I mean, you had CEOs that literally, you know, they just defaulted on a few bonuses for a couple of years, and that was it. You know, they had three or four fall guys, but most of them were patsies. I mean, they were kind of openly running, you know, like what's truly a Ponzi scheme. But I mean, like, you know, even companies that run like, you know, the hated, you know, mid-level pyramid marketing schemes and stuff like that, I mean, they still continue to fully operate. I mean, you really don't have any type of repercussions, you know, either financially or through corporal punishment or anything. I mean, You know, it's like if you go and embezzle $60 million like Wells Fargo, what's going to happen? You're going to get a stern talking to by, you know, Feinstein or, you know, a senator. You know, it's like I was appalled at, like, these memes that were going around, you know, like showing, you know, I don't think it was Dianne Feinstein. I think it was one of the other ones, but it was one of the lady senators. You know, she's, like, really chewing out this dude from Wells Fargo, you know, and he's sitting there like, you know, I mean, he's, you know, he's obviously got a concerned look on his face, but I mean, he just took a butt chewing, you know. It's like, this guy literally just you know, ruined, like, a lot of people's lives and stole money from these people openly and gave incentives to his company to continue this type of behavior. And he literally, I mean, just kind of lost, you know, like, lost some revenue. He got fined a little bit. I mean, it was like a total slap on the wrist. I mean, that guy should have been taken out into the public square and either humiliated or, you know, like they do in Singapore, just took, you know, five good, hard, you know, cane whacks across the back. You know, I mean, whatever it takes. I mean, that guy should, I mean, there should have been some type of repercussion that was so, you know, that was so substantial that it made everybody look at that and go, hey, you know what? I'm going to make sure I'm not screwing up like that. But there's not. And so it just, it incentivizes other people to be the bigger bully or, you know, the smarter bully and to continue to take advantage of all the people that they can take advantage of.
Well, and it's always us, the taxpayer, that has to bail this stuff out. I mean, honestly, that's who is always on the hook when all these guys take all these risks and make all these mistakes. And it used to be that they should be on the hook because they're the ones that took the risks.
Oh, sure. Sure. Yeah, but, well, you know, but again, you know, it's also this kind of this culture that we're in. It's like as a taxpayer, you know, it's like we so much money is stolen from us through our taxes that we can't even really understand how we've paid taxes. So it's like if you were never franchised with your money, like, you know, because, you know, especially when you're just an employee and they've already taken out the taxes, you don't ever really feel that bite. So you don't really feel like you're attached to that money that you've lost. So then when people are squandering that money, it's like a perfect storm. It's like they're just like, oh, okay, well, I don't really, you know, I can't really quantify what that money was because I never had it to give. And I think before, you know, before this idea of income tax and before we actually just started taking the money out without the consent of really the employee or whoever's right. getting taxed, I think that people really, you know, took their tax money seriously and they really took, you know, everything that they did a little bit more seriously. But, you know, it's kind of like, well, it was never mine in the first, there was never really mine in the first place. So, you know, who cares? And, you know, it's kind of a sad state.
Yeah, it really is a sad state. Well, in the last couple of minutes we got in the show, if people want to get a hold of you or find out more information about you, where can they go online?
They can go to electjustinmurda.com. That's kind of, you know, my political aura. We're actually going to update that. I'll be kind of rehashing my game plan, and then we'll be looking at some new offices to run for in the near future here. We've kind of been looking at ways to expand the Libertarian Party. I've always been, you know, like a pretty much a straight ticket Republican voter my whole life, and I just kind of felt that, you know, maybe a little bit of change is needed. I think that, you know, maybe standing back away from the party and working, you know, with the elements of a strictly libertarian or liberty-based party was, you know, kind of what I needed to incentivize or maybe help acclimate some of the Republicans or even disenfranchised Democrats that I know. You know, kind of find a base or an identity and stuff. And I think it's really been great. We've worked really hard over the last year to make that party better and stronger and fall into line with what, you know, we really wanted to as true conservatives kind of be. And so, I'm really excited for the future. I'm really excited for you. I'm really happy about your campaign and I'm glad that, I'm glad to know you. I really appreciate this position in life, and I really am truly working hard on the benefit of all my fellow citizens out there to try to make this a better place for our kids and our future.
And that's what it's all about. And I really appreciate you, Justin, for your fight, and also for having that life experience and living outside the United States, seeing the way the rest of the world works and coming back and wanting to do something about it. I know we're going to see more of you in the political future, and I look forward to having you on again. So thanks for joining me on Patriot Radio today.
Great. Thank you. See you again.
All right, Justin Murta, the former candidate for insurance commissioner. I know we're going to see him again running for some other offices. And you heard his take. I mean, very knowledgeable on the health insurance system, very knowledgeable on not only the free market, but what practically can be done to kind of turn some things around. And a lot of you that have been suffering under Obamacare, we've got to get the right solutions. It's not replacing Obamacare. It's getting rid of it and allowing the free market to work through some of those solutions that we were talking about and really getting off the backs of our doctors. My goodness gracious. It's kind of like what we do to our teachers, trying to dictate every single thing that they do. And all that ends up happening as a result of that is people just leave. They say, I don't want to be part of this anymore. And now we're seeing a doctor and a dentist shortage that is getting increasingly worse and not really a lot of room in the future or margin of error. I mean, we just don't have the ability to allow all these doctors to go away and not have a lot of people coming up behind them because the baby boom generation is getting older. And there are a lot of people that are going to need treatment. So it was really good to hear that perspective. And once again, at the top of the hour, I talked about the breaking news that Ryan Zinke, the congressman out of Montana, being tapped by Donald Trump for Secretary of the Interior, beating out Kathy McMorris Rogers from our area. And kind of brings an interesting close to this little chapter in regards to Kathy potentially stepping down and that congressional seat opening up. So I do want to take a moment here to thank everybody and their outpouring of support and just all the well wishes and prayers we received over the last week. It was just terrific to witness that. And I know Victoria, and I know that I personally really appreciated that, and it meant a lot to us. So I want to thank all of you out there, and we are going to continue to push freedom forward, and especially the 51st state. Well, this is Matt Shea. Thank you once again for joining me on Patriot Radio today. May God bless all of you, and may he make this generation the greatest one.